Movement has the biggest deals of the holiday season and the sleekest watches around, whether you're gifting for family, friends, or yourself. Shop 30 to 60% off Movement's variety of designs, colorways, and functionalities. From the thinnest automatic dress watch under $500 to waterproof guarantee adventure-ready sport watches to rare ceramics. Be the good gifter this year. Shop 30 to 60% off now at Movement.com and enjoy fast and free shipping. That's MVMT.com.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates, plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Pollock and Thurston here on this special Thursday edition of the program. I am John Pollock, reporting from Canada, along with America's own Brandon Thurston. Hello, Brandon.
I'm here. Yes, I'm here. I'm here in the United States, and I think, you know, we would be remiss to not acknowledge right off the top the accurate polling of one Terry Bollea, who did have pretty accurate polling, I think we have to admit.
I mean, when it comes down to very tight races and you're looking at Nate Silver or Terry Bollea, I think that this election might cause some analysis into the various polls and such. I don't know how far we're going to go down the political spectrum on today's show, but Linda McMahon might force us to engage a little bit with that, as she is the co-chair of the transition team. I mean, of all these names that have been in and out of Trump world over the last 8 years, one of the stalwarts right by his side, without fail, without public conflict of any sort, Linda McMahon has been there right by his side. And look at this this contribution that she helped lead with this super PAC.
Just in this year, $10 million to the Make America Great Again Inc. PAC, an additional $800,000 to Trump 47 Committee Inc., and you know, thousands and thousands of dollars just in this year to others, to other Republican Party causes. There's been, and this was slightly down from, I believe, 2020, but you know, this is basically standard consumption for her.
Well, we will, I'm sure, be seeing more of Linda McMahon. I mean, as we will shift over in just a few minutes. We're doing this show on Thursday because Wednesday evening was the TKO earnings report and call with analysts. So thus we are doing this a day later. But as we kind of look at, you know, we are approaching the second Trump administration, and there on Tuesday night, right before he was there to deliver his acceptance speech, is Dana White introducing the president-elect. I mean, it's very hard to divorce politics from, especially MMA, but pro wrestling as well, and what impact a second Trump administration might permeate into the industry that we cover.
Linda McMahon, Hulk Hogan, Donald Trump. I saw even Hulk Hogan's old friend, Bruce Beefcake. I don't know if they're best friends or not anymore, but he was even wearing a shirt with Donald Trump faces all over it. In any case, as I was telling you a couple days ago, I think this it raises questions about, well, what's going to happen with the federal investigation, the criminal federal investigation that we know, according to the Wall Street Journal's report in February, is happening in the Southern District of New York. That is a federal investigation with U.S. attorneys. The U.S. attorney leading Southern District of New York is Damian Williams, who is a presidential appointee. It had to be confirmed by the Senate, but it was a presidential appointee in 2021 from Joe Biden. I was looking into the law, if my reading of the law is correct. The president has the power to appoint who the U.S. attorneys are. So presumably, Donald Trump would have the ability to replace Damian Williams or to replace him with people who are going to pursue investigations and crimes more along the lines of what he's interested in pursuing, maybe prosecuting his enemies or whatever it may be. But it does raise the question about whether Linda McMahon's connection to Vince McMahon and that connection to Donald Trump is going to have any effect or influence on what's going to happen with this federal investigation, which is causing the civil lawsuit filed by Janelle Grant to be put on hold until December 11th. And it raises the question about that timing of December 11th, that is, you know, a month and change after the election. It's curious to know whether that had any, whether that was a factor at all in setting that stay date. We don't know.
Yeah. These are not the issues that Politico or Pod Save America are necessarily dissecting, but in our world, these are stories to at least monitor. It might, there may be, there may be cause for impact, maybe not. But I think like all these things are on the table. When you had the plaintiffs in the UFC antitrust suit, I mean, part of their concern was the idea of this going into a second Trump administration, of if that would be disadvantageous for them. And yes, they have the settlement for the Kung Lee suit, but you still have this outstanding one with the Cajun Johnson class of fighters as well. So it's all these kind of moving targets that I think we will continue to monitor. But until January, you're not really going to know. And quite frankly, it'll be quite into the administration that maybe we can look back at whether this causes any kind of seismic shift with any of these stories.
And along those lines, when we were talking to Stephen P. New about his lawsuit, where he's representing Kevin Kelly and the Tate twins against AEW, we were discussing the possibility of raising or filing an unfair labor practice with the Department of Labor. That's something that's going to be a lot harder to do, if not impossible to do, if you have a Republican president versus a Democratic president. So there's these stories where it's going to affect some things just because that's the federal government and we're working within the law here. The Ring Boy scandal the Ring Boy lawsuit is in Maryland state. So that is a state case. And when we're talking about the Ring Boy lawsuit, we're talking about the Janelle Grant lawsuit. These are civil lawsuits. Even if, you know, in your wildest dreams, if President Trump ends up pardoning Vince McMahon, he cannot pardon him from a civil lawsuit. But then again, I don't know if Donald Trump gets as much power as it sounds like he wants, who knows what will be possible as it relates to the rule of law. But I think, you know, there are going to be these small ways in which this will affect our analysis of various legal situations.
Well, let's transition into TKO's third quarter earnings report. And just because you mentioned it, was curious to go through the filings. And in all of these filings, they typically introduce all of the...
No Ring Boy lawsuit.
Yeah, the Ring Boy lawsuit was not mentioned in among other lawsuits that they are facing or legal updates and such. I mean, it was technically filed in the fourth quarter, but
yes.
Still, they usually, you know, do give focus on this, and obviously was not brought up on the earnings call itself, which I don't think anyone expected it to be.
No, not brought up in Alex Sherman's interview with Mark Shapiro that released this morning either. No, I mean, I don't know. I don't know if it's just a matter of it was filed in Q4, not in Q3. We'll see. You know, we'll look at it'll be the annual filing that they'll be filing next, because you don't do a Q4 quarterly report. You do an annual report at the end of the year. Maybe it'll be in there. Again, WWE is a defendant here. TKO is even a defendant in that case. And they do mention, obviously, the antitrust lawsuit, which is going to cost them hundreds of millions of dollars over the course of years. And they do mention the Janelle Grant lawsuit as well, which they are named defendants in WWE's.
So for the quarter, TKO hauled in $681.2 million in revenue, which is up 52% from the same quarter last year. WWE seeing a very healthy increase in revenue, up to $326.3 million. UFC's revenue was down this quarter, primarily because they had one less numbered pay-per-view and two fewer Fight Night cards. There was also a lot of focus on the Sphere event, which took place in September. And while not getting into the specific finances of that show, I mean, I think the quote was, it took a lot out of us, which, I mean, for TKO, it sounded like that was a enormously expensive show, although mentioning it was also their highest grossing event. And Mark Shapiro, to no one's shock, welcoming title sponsorships if they should come their way in the future, loved being in business with Riyadh Season to present UFC 306 and underwrite some of these extraordinary costs for the Sphere event.
It cost, to disclose, it cost them, what, $20
million? $20 million was the, yeah, reported figure that Riyadh Season kicked in. Yeah. For
their gate was a little bit more than that. Just the gate alone, let alone media revenue.
Yes. I don't think this was a case. This was hardly any kind of money loser for the company. It was just that the expenses were so significant in comparison.
Not the margin accretion that they're used to on a numbered UFC paper.
Yes, yeah. We had lots of definitions from Mark Shapiro in this. Net income for the quarter was $57.7 million for the period. And Brandon, why don't you tell us the UFC makeup versus WWE and which side is contributing more when it comes to profitability?
UFC is always a little more profitable just because they're running fewer events. So it's less expense because of fewer events, and their ticket prices are a lot higher. Their sponsorship revenue is a lot higher. But so they're usually pretty comparable. It sort of goes back and forth in terms of who generates more revenue. We did have UFC generating a little bit more revenue than WWE in this quarter, but it's been the other way around in other quarters. So anyway, but if we look at, we don't get a net income. So net income is like the most final, form of profit. I don't know how it works in other countries, but like in the United States, we have your gross income on your paycheck, and then they show your net pay, which is after all the taxes and whatnot are taken out. Of course, if you're an independent contractor working for some company such as W or AEW, they leave that for you to handle yourself at the end of the year. But anyway, adjusted EBITDA, which is their favorite way to describe profit, which is basically I would say don't even think about this as profit so much as think about this as this is what TKO would like you to think about in terms of how well their business is performing, because they're taking out not only interest, taxes, depreciation, amortization, but they're also taking out certain legal expenses. Sometimes it's stock compensation. It's just things that they don't want you to consider that aren't regular costs. Anyway, profitability. We had $195.6 million for UFC, $175. So again, as usual, UFC a little bit more profitable than WWE.
Yeah, you had WWE ahead of UFC, not by a crazy amount in media rights, but that is not going to be the case in the fourth quarter, because obviously this is their short-term contract that they're having with the USA Network. So instead of getting their $75 million for the quarter, it's going to be $25 million that they have for this three-month stay on the USA Network before they move to Netflix. Live event revenue, obviously WWE, they stage so many more events than the UFC. They are, you know, well ahead. The big discrepancy between the two is sponsorships. Like WWE, it's growing, but it's a fraction of what UFC dominates in this space. We're not quite at Dude Wipes or some of the other golden sponsors out there that UFC has acquired and turned their octagon into a NASCAR race car.
So it's interesting. If you look at live events for UFC, again, with fewer events, they had just about the same amount of revenue as WWE, which is we've got Saudi events in some quarters that are baked in here. But the live event revenue is similar. And I did the math. And if you look at the WrestleTix estimates, and if you figure WrestleTix is estimating – they're estimating tickets distributed, which includes comps. So if you say 10% comps, something like that, then do the math on the average ticket price. We had an average ticket price that looks like in Q3 of 2023 to be about $95. This is just my estimate. It's not anything that they disclosed. But it looked like it was about $95 in the same quarter of last year. The average ticket sale price, the average ticket that was actually bought, $95 last year. Now about $127. So that's like a 33% increase from year to year. And it informs what we're seeing lately in that there's attendance comparisons that we can make market to market when they go back to the same market with the same show, Raw or SmackDown, house show, pay-per-view, whatever it is. And we are seeing finally, what's the buzzword we can use? Softening. The attendance is finally plateauing. And in a lot of cases, it's down. But I think that's just a case of the demand is getting high. And it's sustaining pretty highly. We've got average, we've got typical attendances around 8,000, 9,000. But the it's not as packed as it used to be. But they're still getting a lot of money out of this because they're charging one-third higher ticket prices, which is something we've talked about recently, looking at how high the WrestleMania prices are this year.
There were also some notes in the filings as it relates to WWE and their involvement with DJ Services, which is not the the company I hired for my son's birthday party, but no, this is rather Dwayne Johnson's company, DJ Services, and paid $300,000 and $700,000 respectively in royalties throughout this past year that Dwayne Johnson acquired. So Dwayne Johnson hauling in $1 million in royalties over this period.
Is that stock-based compensation of approximately $1 million, and as that's in the two quarters that they're describing there? So he's getting compensated in terms of stock as well, yes, as well as royalties.
Yes, it says there, Mr. Johnson also receives annual royalties from WWE and will be entitled to receive royalties in connection with the sale of licensed products that utilize the assigned IP and his name, likeness, and IP in accordance with the DJ Services agreement for the 3 and 9 months ended from September 30th, 2024. The company paid $300,000 and $700,000, respectively, of royalties that were earned by Mr. Johnson. So, nice work when you don't even have to show up and you can just cash that check at the end of all of this. And then we go into the earnings call itself, which we had, man, quite the collection of executives. We had Seth Zaslow opening the call, and we thought we were just going to have, our usual suspects, Ari Emanuel and Schleimer, prepared remarks. And then
Ari Emanuel in canned form only.
Yes. Ari was in and out.
I think he's recording that and he's not in the room.
Probably, yeah. I don't know maybe what his state was post-election, good or bad. I have no idea into the inside of Ari Emanuel. Interesting political calculus that I'm sure he wrestles with. And then we had Schleimer joined by fan of the show, Mark Shapiro, who was in here in his element, if there ever was one. But then we got cameos, not just Lawrence Epstein for a run-in, the elusive Nick Khan making an appearance on an earnings call. Maybe his first on a TKO call.
Pretty sure it was his first since the TKO merger. Yeah.
So Nick Khan always in the background, but we did hear from the different parties here. So some of the highlights, I thought there was going to be a little more pushback when it came to the recent acquisition that TKO made of the Endeavor assets, which include PBR, IMG, and On Location.
That would have been nice though.
The stock has not rebounded since this announcement, and while there were questions about it, it was hardly came across as like second guessing, or even Mark Shapiro, who has now been forced to do a 180 on his own stance regarding this, where he was asked on a recent call and said the opposite, that they would not be going in this direction because this was, as we have learned over time, this was a Vince McMahon refusal to include PBR into the TKO story, as we are now dubbing it.
Yes. In Mark Shapiro's words, he was asked about this on the previous earnings call, and he said that they would not be including PBR into TKO because they didn't want to pollute their story. They didn't want to have a stock that was a more complicated story for investors to understand. They wanted to be a very straightforward, it's a WWE and UFC that you're buying here. And they didn't want to complicate that by putting other businesses into that umbrella. And then a couple months later, they've turned around and are going to put, it hasn't happened immediately, but early next year, they will have professional bullfighters, IMG, the talent agency that does sports rights, and On Location, the VIP package and travel package company. So it was discussed, but he certainly wasn't asked what made him change his mind. But we did get that a bit of clarity in the CNBC interview from him that came out earlier today, where he said that Vince McMahon himself did not want that to be part of the deal, and that was part of the compromise of making that deal.
Yeah, interesting how history will read that they had an option of taking either PBR or Vince McMahon, and they made the decision that would not pollute the story.
Right.
By working with Vince McMahon. Let's go to a bit of that interview, because this this was conducted by Alex Sherman at CNBC and spoke Mark Shapiro openly about a recent meeting he had with Vince McMahon. Go on, Mark.
Since we're talking about Vince, one question about Vince. He's not a part of the company anymore. He's sold out.
Yeah.
Do you still hear from him at all?
I had breakfast with him a few weeks ago just to check in. Been a long time. Haven't heard from him at all. Obviously, the series on Netflix came out. I wanted to see kind of where he was. By the way, he couldn't have been more cooperative. He couldn't have been nicer. I mean, he was a total pro at breakfast, if you will. It's a one-on-one get-together. But he's out of the business entirely. He doesn't make decisions. He's not on the board. He doesn't opine. We don't consult him. He's got some litigation that he's working through. And frankly, he wants the privacy and the time to work through it, which is great because in the meantime, we're going to keep building TKO and WWE and expanding the horizon, expanding the opportunities. And by the way, he's still a shareholder. Not the shareholder he once was, but he's still a shareholder.
But he's supportive of the direction WWE is going in and has gone.
Couldn't have been more positive, but I wasn't asking for his opinion.
Number one, very noted. I was not asking for this man's opinion. Two other observations/questions. Number two, stating he's going through some litigation right now might be the greatest understatement I have ever heard in one of these settings. Number three, Brandon, what action would I have to conduct myself in if I came to breakfast with you for you to label me a pro at breakfast? Like, would I have to come with my order all set to go and I'm right on top when the waitress or waiter comes and asks for my order and I'm efficient?
Well, it means that you didn't throw coffee on me, as Vince McMahon has been known to throw coffee on Ashley Massaro. It means that you didn't throw your eggs and bacon at me or something, and then they had a civil conversation, I guess. I one thing that is interesting to me, that despite what David Schumacher said in the Netflix documentary, Vince still does have stock, which is what we've concluded from the disclosures that are out there as of April this year. He does still have more than 8 million TKO shares, which comes out to about 4.7% of the stock, depending on what they're floating. And he hasn't sold all of it. I know it's a simpler story to understand. He has sold a lot of it. He has sold over $1 billion. He has liquidated more than $1 billion in TKO stock in the last 14 months or so. So he's got a lot of cash, but he still has quite a bit of stock. And there we have Mark Shapiro. I don't know when that interview was recorded, if it was yesterday or what. But as far as he knows, he's still got some stock.
Other topics that were brought up in the call, we had an interesting response when – so this was about a month ago that Dana White, after one of the – I think it was one of the Contender Series cards, was asked about getting into boxing. And he gave his most sort of steadfast answer that he – will be diving into boxing and likening their role to that of HBO, whether that means as a distributor of fights. He didn't go into that much further, but your takeaway was that this was something very high on the priorities if you are taking Dana White at his word, which is a very dangerous game to be playing. And Mark Shapiro was then confronted with this with analysts. And should we be concerned that there is going to be mergers or acquisitions on the table when it comes to TKO getting into boxing?
Some off-the-cuff comments from Dana White do not translate into a strategy that we're communicating to the street, right? Dana says a lot of things and has a lot of passions, and that's why we love him. He's also the best promoter, the sport of MMA, and frankly, if it was boxing, has or will ever see. What I can tell you is boxing at its best is confused and fragmented. At its worst, it's broken. And we think the sport presents an interesting growth opportunity for us. Dana White, and I should mention Nick Khan, have deep expertise in longstanding relationships in what they call the sweet science, otherwise known as boxing. And if we were to get involved in boxing, we would expect to do so in an organic way, not an M&A way. So, i.e., we're not writing a check. And if we launch the vertical at any time, we kind of see it as doing it with a partner who would fund it and pay us to operate.
And if I was ever writing a book on the head of the UFC, it would be titled "Dana Says a Lot of Things" in quotations. what he means by boxing being broken, it is that boxers have a lot more rights in the United States because of something called the Muhammad Ali Act than they do in mixed martial arts, where you have to work a lot more with your fighters because they do have some levels of leverage. But nonetheless, take all of Dana White's comments as for entertainment purposes only is pretty much what Mark Shapiro was conveying there, as to not scare anybody.
Right. So, and they were pretty explicit about not putting any more non-sports assets. I guess they could do a boxing business and that would be a sports asset. But there was also conversation separate from what you're talking about the Endeavor assets that maybe Ari Emanuel himself is going to bid on. And he was just reassuring investors and anybody listening that TKO is not going to take any more Endeavor assets into TKO.
Yeah, Rich Greenfield might have been the most pressing at the end of things, enough that they just halted the call after his question and follow-up.
Where, two light shit analysts on this call.
Yes, yeah, they came at you with the 1-2 punch, pardon the pun. Other topics brought up, obviously, the UFC media rights that are going to be a huge story in 2025, that they look to be going into their negotiations pretty imminently in the first quarter of next year. And bringing up the WWE's PLE rights, also being asked about the differences of the pay-per-view model that UFC has versus the WWE's, where they completely license out the pay-per-views. And with UFC, it's kind of a hybrid model where, yes, they license them out to ESPN, but for you, the consumer, you're still spending $80 per show if you're in the US on top of a subscription. And it's sort of these two differing ways of selling your most valuable content, and both are existing in TKO.
Yeah, it's a question that I think it was raised by Brandon Ross, a light shit analyst, about it sort of framed as pay-per-view. Well, yes, pay-per-view is whatever what's the paywall now, $70, $80 for UFC pay-per-view on ESPN Plus.
Yeah.
Unless you're in Malaysia, it's lower cost. And that's obviously
legal by the way.
Yes.
I don't want to get Adam Schefter controversy here.
Oh, and they love to sue you if you're misusing their pay-per-view. But anyway, obviously you're making a lot of money doing that, but it's your best content. It's the most attractive content you've got, and it's severely limiting the reach. It's sort of the trade-off, and this is the way that UFC has always been. It's the way that pro wrestling always was, and at least in WWE's case until 2014. And I think Brandon Ross was framing it as, you know, MMA is sort of in its infancy relative to wrestling, which has been around for like 100 years. MMA as a sport that people recognize has only been around for maybe a couple decades at most. And maybe there's still a lot of room for growth into American culture of the popularity of MMA if those pay-per-views, if that big content was on a bigger distribution platform, like a cable network or a broadcast network or a major streaming service. And I'm really curious to think about how they calculate that, because it's not something you can really experiment in. You either got to go all in or not, and you take this huge risk, and maybe it pays off and maybe it doesn't, which is kind of what WWE did with the network. So I've been really interested in how they calculate that. As I recall, though, Mark Shapiro sort of spun off into talking about how great their demographics are and things like that.
Yeah, he talked about the gender diversity, just all the different nationalities, stuff. Everyone is a fan of UFC. Everybody. And then, of course, the other, I guess, key topic was Netflix, with the move coming in January. And they were asked about sponsors coming on board, what this has been like for WWE working with the streamer. We learned that was this known before, of Minute Maid coming on as a sponsor for WWE? Because they noted the fact Minute Maid came on board with WWE on Netflix, and now they have bought into other advertising opportunities at Netflix. So Minute Maid, look out for that on your WWE programming.
I don't know if that was known about ahead of time, but I think it is. It's stark when you look at the difference between the sponsorship revenue of UFC versus that of WWE, in that, like, in this Q3 that they just reported, $74 million for UFC, just $22 million for WWE, which is better, a lot better. It's about a third better than the prior year quarter. So this is better than usual, but still, I don't know what the math, that's almost a quarter of what UFC is able to do. And I guess that's just, you know, it's the long tradition of pro wrestling having trouble selling sponsorship revenue because of actual demographics or perception of what pro wrestling is.
On the Netflix topic, this is where we did get the cameo from Nick Khan, and this is what he had to state about WWE's move to Netflix, what it will mean for the company on a transformative level.
If you think about it in perspective, 20 years ago, Monday Night Raw was on National Network, which became the National Network, which became TNN, which became Spike, which is now Paramount. Now we're going to Netflix. So forget their sub count that they have at this moment. It's 650 million potential viewers globally for our product. So the ability to go out, Andrew Schleimer mentioned in his prepared remarks, and then slightly after that, the growth year over year in WWE sponsorship, we're expecting even more growth once Netflix kicks in January because of the global reach and because of the power of Netflix in so many different markets.
And it's also worth noting that today, Warner Brothers Discovery had their earnings call. And just for a comparison, because we know that Dynamite and Collision will be simulcast on Max next year, this quarter, Max announced 7.2 million additional global subscribers, bringing their total subs to 110.5 million. So a far cry from Netflix.
And it's only going to be U.S., so we should only be focusing on like the domestic number, which is like 52 million. And some of that, some 4 million of that is Discovery Plus. So I would say it's like high 40 million. And that includes a lot of people who just have traditional HBO that I don't know how often they're really using the Max streaming service, that they might have access to it.
And Netflix in the U.S. is around 80 million, that ballpark?
70 million or so.
70,
I'm looking at a table right now, and I can tell you. It's U.S. The U.S.-Canada number, excuse me, was 84.8 million on their Q3 report. So I would estimate that if you just, you know, take the percentage of the population, you're what, one-ninth of our population? It's 76, excuse me.
These are mind-blowing numbers. It's hard to grasp the volume that Netflix is piling.
It is
on
by
top.
Far it is by far the largest streamer. And in fact, if you're in 76 million homes, and that's not even considering we can, you know, do some theory about, well, there's a lot of password sharing happening here, so that maybe it's even more than 76 million U.S. homes. That's more than any U.S. cable network at this point, which is struggling to be around 65 million, I think, maybe high 60 millions at this point. And that's only going to continue to go in the trend lines that they're going, and that cable's going to go down. And Netflix has continued to grow here, despite, remember the days of 2022 when everybody was freaking out because Netflix didn't have sequential growth.
Before we move on, any final takeaways you had that stood out in any significant way?
I think that's the ticket sales, as far as W stories, the ticket sales and the sponsorship revenue, doing better, but still a far cry from UFC. And they are, if you're a W fan who likes to go to WB events, get used to complaining on Twitter about the prices being really high, because as long as they're as popular as they are, as long as that demand is there, Mark Shapiro is going to extract that revenue from you.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is making it easy to get vaccinated. Care is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. Care is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
This month on the Post Wrestling Cafe, we are bringing you two editions of Rewind Away, starting off with a film review of Death Warrior. As described, the 2009 classic features five of the best mixed martial arts champions from around the world forced to play a deadly game. Plus, we tackle TNA's Turning Point from 2009. Karen Peterson and Bruce Lord will be covering the historic Crossover 2 event, plus an Ask Away mailbag show, Rewind to SmackDown, and Collision Course. $6 a month gets you access to the Post Wrestling Cafe. Margins were fantastic in this quarter. Well, we're going to improve our margins right now because we are expanding and being joined by a very special guest right now. He is a journalist, a freelance journalist out of the UK. He has done work for The Telegraph, for Yahoo, many different outlets, and he joins us now. He is Robert Jackman, who ended up being in attendance for the WWE events that were staged in Riyadh this past weekend with Crown Jewel and then the subsequent Raw taping. Robert, thank you so much for taking some time to join us today.
Hi, Robert.
No problem. Thanks very much for having me. Good to see you both.
And where are you joining us from today, Robert?
So I'm still in the Arab region. I'm in a lovely five-star hotel, but sadly the curtains don't look so so glamorous. But the view behind was so bright, the glare off the lights. But I'm in the United Arab Emirates. So I'm in Abu Dhabi, so a two-hour flight from Riyadh. So
why don't you tell us what brought you to Saudi Arabia this past weekend and seeking out these WWE events? Were they the first WWE shows you've seen in the country?
In the country of Saudi Arabia, yes. So I'm a WWE fan myself. You know, I've been to shows in the UK, in the US. I was in the Middle East anyway for work. So I was over here in the United Arab Emirates, which, yeah, for anyone that doesn't know, is a neighboring country of Saudi Arabia. But you still need a sort of two-hour flight to get to Riyadh. And I've been curious for a while. You know, I enjoy watching the Saudi shows. I've been there before for work. So I figured I would take the chance, get some tickets for Crown Jewel and for Raw, which was very easy to do. As I said to you guys, I was surprised by how cheap they were. But yeah, I'll let you lead on what you'd like to know about the show and my experience.
Well, why don't you tell us first about just the process of getting tickets and kind of the demand for tickets and as well, like how you kind of just observed like the environment for these shows. Like, did this feel like a pretty major event for those attending?
Yeah, so I think these shows sold out very quickly. I mean, I was waiting for the tickets to go on sale, and people might have noticed this before with the Saudi shows. They don't tend to put the tickets on sale until about 2 weeks, 3 weeks. You know, so if you're factoring international travel, that's pretty tricky. So I got them, I think, 2 days after they went up. You know, you had seats in the stands for kind of the equivalent of $13, $14. I think I paid around $40 for a pretty good seat with a view. I could have been on the floor for about $150. But I remember checking back a couple of days later because I thought, you know what, maybe I should get myself a better seat after all. I'll have a look how much those ringside ones are. And by then it was pretty much sold out. So, you know, my understanding is that for all of the takes there are on the relationship with Saudi Arabia, I don't think they struggle to shift tickets in that market. You know, when I got there, it was pretty, you know, it's not the biggest arena. I think it was kitted out for around 15,000, 16,000. So kind of the same for what you might see for some of the lower PLEs in the US, something like Bad Blood, for example. Completely packed, you know, 98%, I think, Saudi natives, although hard to tell because people travel from other Arab countries to go to them. But, you know, it certainly appeared to be an Arabic-speaking, organic audience, WWE fans, you know, absolutely full with T-shirts, you know, people wearing shirts they clearly bought from shows in the past. Like, there was one guy, and he was Saudi. He was wearing a T-shirt that said Leeds 316 on it. And as a Brit, I was like, wait, the WWE hasn't been to Leeds. And I looked it up, and I think it was 2016 or something like this. So, you know, hopefully he hasn't been wearing it all that time. But clearly it's been in the back of his closet. But, you know, a lot of people wearing merch. You know, they were a loud crowd. I think everyone heard that. There was no doubt. So, yeah, for me, it was very much the kind of experience I'm used to at a WWE show, but in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. I guess one thing that's been in the air is the notion that, well, maybe eventually, I mean, given how much money they're making for each one of these events, WWE is getting about $50 million every event, that and they're pursuing site fees around the world with all their PLEs. I mean, imagine the money that they would be able to get potentially for a WrestleMania or another major PLE, mm-hmm. like a Royal Rumble in Saudi Arabia. And I guess especially with WrestleMania, we know that wrestling fans from all over the world travel to the WrestleMania city. And it would be an unusual thing, I think, for Western people to imagine, you know, traveling to Saudi Arabia for a wrestling event. Is that something you could see happening with, like, wrestling fans from all over the world, from the United States, from the UK, traveling to Riyadh, let's say, for a WrestleMania?
Yeah, I mean, I've been thinking about that. I don't know if it's necessarily a priority for what the Saudis would want. I mean, I've been to quite a lot of kind of sporting events in the Gulf, you know, often with a state sponsor. Like, I've been to a Formula One race, I've been to a big motorboating race. I've been to, you know, previews for the Qatar World Cup. And sometimes, you know, there is clearly a focus on bringing people in. And you look, for example, at like the UFC events that take place here in Abu Dhabi. Mm-hmm. You know, I think they really want people, the Emiratis want people traveling for that. They want to show these influencers. They want to show that, I don't know, Ronaldo or Eminem or whoever is at the show. The Saudi WWE events don't feel like that to me. Like, I think they have a strong domestic market. And I think what we've seen in Europe is, because there's, you know, whenever I go to a show in the UK, there's lots of people whispering excitedly about, are we going to get WrestleMania in London? And, you know, as someone that is broadly familiar with like WWE's revenues, I just question what's the point. Because if they can make as much money as they do off a show like Money in the Bank or at Clash at the Castle, you know, because I've been to some of those. I went to Day One, the PLE in 2022 in Atlanta a few years ago, you know, and it seems to me like the WWE strategy is to move away from doing those kind of non-Big Five or Big Four US events. So, you know, I think if I were in a commercial position at WWE, I'd think, well, why do that? Because if you can get this much money for Crown Jewel, which is becoming a branding in its own right, or for, you know, Night of Champions, why would you bring why would you bring WrestleMania, or why would you bring SummerSlam to Saudi Arabia? But, you know, I don't think I think the show would take off if they did, but I just question why do that? Because you can make the money that you do on a WrestleMania.
Yeah. I'm thinking of, you know, what's it like to be a tourist in Riyadh, for example? Because you were telling me in your email team about there's public decency regulations that people have uphold when they're in.
Yeah. So when I bought the ticket, I sort of read the terms and conditions out of interest. And, you know, there was something just kind of buried in there that I'm sure is just standard in Saudi Arabia. But, you know, it made my eyes kind of be like, what? It was like, you know, you agree to abide by public decency regulations. I mean, most of them, I read them, and there was lots of things like, you know, that I think are kind of unwritten rules in the West anyway. No spitting, no swearing at people, no threatening behavior. You know, it didn't say anything about religious modesty or anything like that. But I had my eyes wide open for that kind of stuff. You know, like I've always been someone that's interested in the WWE Saudi relationship. And I think the one thing I did notice, which I pointed out to you guys earlier, is that before each, you know, like at any PLE, we were treated to the video packages before every match. The only one we did not get was Liv Morgan and Nia Jax. And straight away, I thought, that's a bit odd, particularly since we sat in an arena where the lights were out. You know, it wasn't like anything alternate was shown. We weren't shown any kind of preview for a sort of secret domestic Saudi show 6 months down the line. We sort of sat in a dark arena, and I could see a monitor from where I was sitting, and I could see that, you know, they were showing the promo on the monitor, and I've seen Crown Jewel since on broadcast, you know, it's there. And I was looking into, so my strong suspicion is that they decided that that package did not fit with the kind of content that could be shown to a crowd in Saudi Arabia. And I looked into this, and I don't know if you guys know, but in 2018, a similar segment was pulled. And I think that Saudi Arabia apologized. But yes. No, it wasn't pulled. Sorry. It was shown and they apologized. Yeah. And that was actually a male only event. That was at the Greatest Royal Rumble. So, you know, if I had to wager money on that, I think maybe WWE is now trying to avoid those situations happening and had flagged that package as something that might not be. So I think the fans would have loved it. You know, I was there on Raw. They absolutely popped for the Women's Battle Royal. They really liked Io Sky, you know, but we just sort of sat in darkness. And it was very odd because anyone that's been to a live WWE show knows, you know, they're kind of hyperactive. They don't like losing the momentum in the room. There's always something going on. But for those 3 minutes, there really wasn't.
Beyond the video package, I mean, when we're watching the broadcast of it, I think you can see certain aspects where they are promoting Riyadh, they're promoting Saudi Arabia as a great destination. Like, you can understand, like, that is kind of part and parcel with these shows. In terms of the in-arena experience, were there any instances where, like, you felt it was specifically being catered to the promotion of the General Entertainment Authority, or did you feel that this was somewhat other than the video package, felt like a regular WWE experience for someone traveling?
Yeah, I know. It's funny you should say the word. Yeah, because I think actually this to me felt like the most kind of the stuff going around the event was much bigger than any WWE event. You know, when I go to the ones in the UK, we have a lot of great, you know, we have people that put on these brilliant events, like third party people that do pub quizzes, you know, they kind of do, yeah, trivia nights. They might do meetups with wrestlers. Nothing like that happens in Saudi Arabia. But what there is, there was a huge WWE merch store outside, you know, a kind of big, it must have taken at least a couple of days to put up. It was a whole merch store itself, selling shirts, selling caps, selling everything. And then the top, you had probably about 12 PS5 consoles where you could play WWE 2K24 for as long as you wanted for free, you know, with no kind of cost or anything like that. They had several big installations. So they had Jay's Yeet glasses, you know, kind of big size for you to take the photo in front of. They had the Cody American Nightmare mask. They had a lovely replica of the Crown Jewel belt, which looks even better when it's, you know, the size of a caravan. But yeah, so there was this whole kind of infrastructure around the event. There was a lot more signage than you would normally see. So, you know, the whole of the outside of Muhammad Abdo Arena was plastered with big billboards of Gunter and Cody Rhodes. So, you know, it felt they were really investing to make it an event, which, you know, from what I know about Saudi Arabia, I think that's the sort of thing they're looking for. You know, this is a country where these kind of big live public events are still quite a novel thing, you know. So I think they are trying to turn it into something that's entertaining. Then, of course, you've also got the WWE Experience, which is the mini little sort of theme park attraction that I had the chance to go to as well, which is deeply surreal. But
and just go back to the women's matches. I mean, we've obviously the first several had no women's matches on them. Then they started to do women's matches on it and sort of position it as, you know, I mean, this is a country where women generally don't participate in sports, if I'm not wrong about that. And so, like, how is that received by the crowd when there are women's matches in the ring?
Yeah, I mean, Crown Jewel, we started with the Bloodline match. You know, the crowd was so into it. And then when the next match was the women's four-way tag, and I noticed quite a lot of people, and I took a video of it, sort of heading for the door to go outside. And I think part of me thought, oh no, you know, like, really? Like, they're just going outside. It's a women's match. Come on. You know, like, you realize what people in the internet say about these Saudi shows. And I did a sort of bit of investigating, actually, and I found out something quite odd, which I'll try to cover as quickly as possible. So, I mean, everyone knows there's no alcohol in Saudi Arabia. That is well known. It turns out there is no soft drinks or food whatsoever allowed or for sale in the arena. Nothing. However, outside the arena, there is a sort of row of kind of bougie coffee stands and, you know, alcohol-free mojitos and sort of, you know, kind of quite upmarket soft drink options. But you can't take the drinks back in. And the sense I got was that, you know, a lot of people had been in their seats for about an hour before the show started. It's an air-conditioned arena, but it's still a little hot in there. And I just think after that immediate energy of the Bloodline match, it seemed to me a lot of fans were going outside to grab a Coke or grab a coffee, and they then have to stay outside, which I just thought logistically was a weird thing. But then having observed that, when I went to Raw the next night, it was the opposite, because we started with the Women's Battle Royal. Crowd so into it, you know, really behind Io Sky, people sort of whooping at everything. And then I think the second match up, I'm trying to think what it was now. Was it? No, it wasn't Dragon Lee. It was a man's singles match. And exactly the same thing happened. There was a sort of big procession of people going outside to get a drink. And I just thought, you know, that just seems to be a logistical flaw, really. Because, you know, with a WWE show, you don't really know what's coming when. Like, I've been caught up in this before in London, like at Money in the Bank, I think. I went to get a beer and then just heard John Cena's music. And I just figured they were showing like a video promo or something come out and he's in the ring. So, you know, I try not to leave my seat, but like, they've got that problem with that rehab show, I think, where a lot of people end up leaving to get a refreshment and then they're outside for 20 minutes. So,
do you have any thoughts, Robert, just in terms of the evolution of a lot of the public stance towards these shows, and also as it relates to like the UFC now being in business with the government and so many of these big boxing fights coming to the country? Yep. That a lot of, like, if you look at the vitriol of 2018, that mm-hmm. has significantly softened this many years later, and that this is going to continue to be a really big hub for these big sporting events and combat sports being one of the key pillars of that strategy.
Yeah, but it's treated so differently, I think, from, say, the boxing. So we've just had a huge boxing match in London, which was officially part of Riyadh's season. And there was a lot of controversy around that because I think they played the Saudi national anthem before. A journalist, a colleague of mine at the Telegraph, his permission to be there was rescinded because a couple of days before he'd been critical of Saudi Arabia. You know, and they, and when I've seen boxing matches there, they love cutting away to celebrities. And there seems to be what they seem to be trying to do with those is present Riyadh as being the hottest place on earth for that night. You know, this is where everyone is. This is where Ronaldo is. You know, this is where all of these A-listers are. They don't do that at the WWE event. So, you know, I kind of think maybe it's that. Maybe that, and I don't think they are being used as some kind of propagandizing tool. I think obviously they help improve Saudi's image, but I think maybe it's that. You know, they certainly don't seem to be making any kind of creative demands. You know, the shows feel as native and as kind of canon as they ever have, I think. So, yeah, I don't know. I feel pretty optimistic. And the other thing I noticed is that, you know, Turki Al-Sheikh is the great Saudi power player in sports. You know, I know you've had guests on your show talking about him before. So I'm 99% sure he was not there at Crown Jewel. And, you know, he's a guy that likes putting himself in the center of things. If you see him at the boxing, you know, he's very much someone that seems to have this kind of main character syndrome. I think he likes being in the spotlight. He wasn't there either, which I thought was kind of interesting. I don't know if that says anything about the relationship, but, you know, the guy that presented Cody and Liv with the belt at the end was the CEO of the GEA. I forget his name, but he, you know, he sort of reports to Turki Al-Sheikh. So, you know, as someone that kind of watches power play in Saudi Arabia generally, like, I thought that was interesting that we didn't see Turki there. He was promoting it a lot on his Twitter, as you might have seen, but he wasn't there at the show in person.
It may have been hard to see, especially in the arena, but at least in one of the video packages we saw, they did a close-up shot of the Crown Jewel Championship, and there were the initials TA that were actually embedded on the championship belts, and that was pretty much the closest kind of connection you had to Turki Al-Sheikh on this.
I didn't notice that.
It was very subtle, but there was a close-up of it at one point. It might have been even on the pre-show. This has been really fascinating, Robert, just to hear from someone actually in person at these events. We have heard from fans in the past that have attended these shows. Do you want to just give people any ways in which they can follow you and some of your work? I know you don't necessarily cover pro wrestling per se, but anything you throw out there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if anyone's got anything interesting or knows anything about the kind of WWE Saudi relationship, I'm on LinkedIn. I think my email address isn't too hard to find online. And yeah, I think, you know, if anyone's thinking about going to a Saudi show, I've got to say I was pleasantly surprised. And having seen some of the prices in Europe, you know, I was doing a bit of kind of back of the cigarette paper packet maths the other day, and I think it genuinely would have been cheaper. Not that I didn't fly all the way from London to Riyadh, I was in the region anyway. I think it would have been cheaper for me to go to this show than it would have been to go to Bash in Berlin or Clash at the Castle, which is kind of astounding when you think about it. But, you know, you look at the kind of ticket prices they're charging, it's, makes a big difference.
They're setting gate records every time out in Europe with these PLEs.
Mm-hmm. They are, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we'll see how the Road to WrestleMania show goes. I think they clearly getting the dollar signs in their eyes when they look at Europe. And, you know, maybe that's no bad thing as a European wrestling fan. But
got to keep those margins up, Robert. That's the name
absolutely
of the game. Thanks so much for staying up late with us and setting up your backdrop for us. We very appreciate you going the extra mile for us. So thanks you so much, Robert, for joining us.
Thank you, Robert.
Thanks, guys.
All right, Robert Jackman joining us, who was at the Saudi Arabia shows this past weekend. He got to take in those shows this past weekend. Is Brandon Thurston going to be heading over to the KeyBank Center on Friday night for
SmackDown? That's Friday, isn't it?
I believe so.
Maybe. I did ride my bike from my house to the last Dynamite at the same venue. So it's maybe I'll do it. We'll have to look at the ticket prices, though.
Okay, well, we will see that dynamic pricing. I mean, it seems like a pretty hot ticket for Buffalo this weekend.
Yes.
Okay, before we sign off, we're going to spend a little bit of time just looking at some of the candidates for the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame. It is Hall of Fame season, Brandon. Were you aware of this?
Yes, it's time to get your I voted sticker out and put it on your shirt and say, yes, I voted in the Hall of Fame.
Yes. You know, this being the year that Big Daddy has fallen off the ballot, that was a tough election result for a lot of citizens to stomach. But
yes.
We're not going to go through all of the different categories. We only have so much time here. But
we're
going to
go through all 48 candidates right now.
Yes, yes. Let's dive right into the Stanley Weston debate. So the deadline is Friday, and for the various regions, you have to achieve 60% of the votes for inclusion. These are broken up into categories that include historical performers, U.S. and Canada, that I think we'll spend most of our time discussing, Japan, Mexico, Europe, and the rest of the world, and then non-wrestlers that go towards your vote count. And there's maximum amounts for each category that you can vote on. Let's start at like U.S. and Canada, because I think that's what most people listening, they're going to be most familiar with and living through a lot of these various careers. Who do you feel, this is a very clogged up section on the ballot, and do you expect to use all seven of your votes in this category?
I'm voting for 1, 2, 3, 4 candidates this year. As I told you earlier, this is probably a very similar ballot to whatever I cast last year. We'll put it on the screen here so people can see who all the candidates are. I'm going to vote for Young Bucks, CM Punk, Roman Reigns, and Cody Rhodes. And I've got stars next to people like Goldberg and the Usos as, I think, strong candidates maybe I'll vote for eventually.
I have not finalized my ballot. I have like my short list of ones. I know in this category, I will be voting for the Young Bucks. I will be voting for CM Punk. I will be voting for Roman Reigns. I will be voting for Cody Rhodes. Those are for sures. And then kind of my on the bubble ones are the Briscoes, John Moxley, and Sami Zayn. I tend to not max out my votes just because they're available for me. I prefer a smaller ballot that I submit. That's my own personal preference. I would argue I think there's some very strong candidates here. I voted in terms of the Young Bucks, Punk and Reigns. I voted for all three of those last year. Cody Rhodes is new this year. And I think with the Young Bucks, I think that there is the argument they are the tag team of this generation, say nothing of the impact of AEW, that I think they had a much more influence on the launch of than Cody Rhodes does. And I think Rhodes, that's going to help his candidacy, but it's even more so for the Young Bucks. Punk, I have believed, has been a Hall of Famer for multiple years. And if there was any question of that, I thought the AEW return solidified that, although the exit is enough that I think that has... That is a negative aspect to Punk. Like, you could argue he did a lot of... He brought AEW up to its peak in popularity, but I think his exit was very detrimental for AEW over something you could argue they have not truly gotten over, the exit of Punk and it being such a momentum shift, the exit of Punk and predating that Cody.
That's something I've talked about with other people, is that what is there anything that makes a case? Is there anything that somebody does that makes their case weaker? Like, let's go to the extreme example. I mean, there was a recall vote on Chris Benoit because he murdered his family. There's allegations against Vince. I think I've heard people say that he should have a recall vote. So anyway, I guess I don't think that. I think you got to do something really terrible for me to make it a real negative against your case. And I guess what I'm saying is that I don't know that Punk, you know, being disruptive and maybe not being a good coworker and getting himself fired necessarily rises to that level in the neighborhood of what you're talking about. Look at how much their business has been hurt by his exit and his absence. Sort of speaks to his, one of the criteria of this Hall of Fame is his drawing power.
And I think this parallels with the Shawn Michaels argument for years.
Yes.
Was somebody that was
in now.
Yeah, and it was almost laughable that he was being debated as a Hall of Fame inductee. And I mean, he caused, I would say he did way more damage in the 90s of his problems that he created in that company than a CM Punk. And I mean, I'm just, that to me is not disqualifying. I think it's, I think,
and I would say Shawn Michaels' case in 1998 or 2000, when he's on his hiatus, is weaker a case especially from a drawing standpoint, than CM Punk, at least a couple of years into his AEW run.
Certainly. Yeah, certainly. Like, Shawn Michaels was, like, for his performance, was not a game changer of a performer. And CM Punk has been in multiple cases. I mean, Brandon, you chart the quarters as close as anyone, and is there a more reliable figure in pro wrestling than a CM Punk segment for either company at this point? Like, it is 9 times out of 10. Like, it's, you can look at one of your charts and it's very evident where the CM Punk segment is. And that was aided by, you know, a great program this year that has elevated Drew McIntyre to his highest. And he had an outstanding year of his career, of which he was injured for most of it as well.
Yeah. It is true, as someone who publishes the quarter hours, that I do see a lot. I sort of hate when people say, yeah, they make these grand declarations about quarter hours and not acknowledging the dirtiness of that data. But we do see a number of quarter hours where I say, yes, even taking those issues into account, that CM Punk is a consistent positive contributor to quarter hour trends in an analysis where it's very hard to do that. He did that in AEW. He's doing that still in WWE. To what extent it's meaningful, when I track the top sellers items on the merchandise shops, and I think in this year, I was just looking at this weekend on WrestleNomics Radio, and like one of his CM Punk shirt for Shop AEW, in the 67 days that it was actually on the store until he was let go, I guess it was still on the store in this year. That doesn't make sense. In any case, he still had a period where he was ranking highly. One of his items was ranking highly on Shop AEW, as well as his like items continued to rank highly on WWE. Maybe that's reflective of being a strong merchandise seller. So he's been a TV draw. Most importantly, he's been a strong merchandise draw. He's been in no shortage of really important and great matches, including, I think you guys just reviewed the John Cena CM Punk Money in the Bank match, which I had not seen at the time, and I watched it after the fact, and I was really blown away by it. So I think he's certainly good enough in the in-ring work aspect, to the extent that you're supposed to take that into account. This is one of the biggest stars of this generation.
Let's talk about Roman Reigns and Cody Rhodes, because I mean, they have been, you know, two of the key people behind this, you know, nearly, you know, 3-year revival of WWE, going back to Cody's return at WrestleMania in 2022. Roman has been the main player for this company that certainly precedes the TKO era, going, you know, really till 2015, when they earmarked him as the heir apparent to John Cena. What do you think is, let's start with Roman Reigns and what you feel are the strongest arguments for Reigns going in, because he is a divisive one among voters.
Can I give you the arguments against him?
Yeah.
He was a huge failure. He was pushed to the moon and over pushed to the moon. He shoved down people's throats. He was not a draw. And maybe you want to even be skeptical that he even is a draw now, it's just the brand that's a draw. And all this business that WWE has done, you know, while he's been one of the main players, has just been an act of inertia, and it should have done even better if not for how, at least we could say how poorly he was used, or how overpushed he was in an era where WWE did become less popular from 2015, which I would mark as the beginning of his big push, where he wins the Royal Rumble in January that year. And from 2015, 16, 17, 18, 19, these are years where it's a multi-year consecutive decline in attendance, in TV ratings, even probably adjusting for cord cutting, in merchandise sales. Their consumer business really went down over the course of time, where he is the top guy. I'm voting for him, by the way.
I think that you have to certainly look at that period, but I think we also have to view it in the sense that, was there a decline in WWE's business? Absolutely. Was this a money losing period? Like, this was still a very profitable period for the company. And was Roman Reigns is your avatar for that period, that I think will collectively be looked upon as among the worst creative eras of the company. Yeah. I would cite from, I would say, 2017 to 2018 right up until the transfer of power. Now, in the wake of that,
the peaceful transfer of power. Yes.
The transfer of power, as we will label it.
I would say avatar is a really good word. I think Roman Reigns was an avatar for Vince McMahon, and that's why he was rejected so strongly.
And when so many people were calling for Reigns to, and I will somewhat defend this period, is that, you know, the turnaround, I think, to the public sentiment of Roman Reigns comes with the heel turn. And that is still, you know, that's 2 years under Vince McMahon that this Bloodline program begins. I don't think it was as hot as it would get from kind of the Sami Zayn period, where it seemed like this became this episodic programming for the company. And you have seen over years the rise of Sami Zayn, the rise of Jey Uso, but the guy that has been the central figure here is Roman Reigns. And when they finally leaned into what the audience,
and that's another argument against that, this Bloodline thing isn't successful until and because of Sami Zayn, not Roman Reigns.
I think, though, you take out Roman Reigns, and do you have that heel figure that can be placed into Roman Reigns' role? Like, I don't view Roman Reigns as just this stand-in that anybody could have played, that even a Drew McIntyre at that time, or you know, Brock Lesnar was not around to be this kind of figure either. I think that Roman Reigns, I think over time, is going to be viewed, like, for better or worse, this guy has been the main player of WWE going on a decade. And through that time, it has been the highest period for this company. And yes, a lot of that gets assigned to, well, it's the WWE brand, but I think it gets this gray area where the negative is on Roman Reigns' part, the positive is because of the brand. I think you have to give both blame and responsibility to the performer in some cases, while also knowing that this guy is wrapped around a company that, you know, is in this guaranteed rights era where it is somewhat turnkey. Like, it was virtually impossible for this company to lose money during these periods.
And the Bloodline, he's the most important character in, even, you know, it's, Sami Zayn has not been heavily involved in the Bloodline storyline for a couple of years now. I know he's dabbling again. But even in recent weeks, as of right now, the Bloodline storyline is popping Quarter Hours, and we're seeing that sort of corroborated, you know, with all the noise that are in Quarter Hours, we're seeing it corroborated with the interest in those particular videos on YouTube. And we're now in this era in with WrestleMania 40, where, he, along with others who are also in this Hall of Fame, main evented WrestleMania two nights, and at almost double the ticket prices of the prior year. And this coming year, will probably be another iteration of that, but that's not what we're counting here, of course. But SmackDown ratings improved, with him as the key figure. Now, SmackDown was canceled. I'm almost talking myself into it, but SmackDown was basically canceled. I wouldn't characterize it that way, but you say, look, SmackDown didn't have the value that they thought it was going to have, and Roman Reigns was the biggest figure there. So why should, you know, why should you look at Roman Reigns positively when you've got this TV deal in the biggest piece of business that companies have today, where it didn't work out as well? Now they got a $287 million deal, up from a $205 million deal. But that was basically the rate of an escalator from 1 year to the next. But I do think he's, you know, in this era where WrestleManias are in stadiums, where he's been the biggest star and the biggest draw of anybody on this roster over the course of, you know, at least 5 years. And WWE is doing really hot business. Business is improving. It's on the upswing in TV ratings and ticket sales, in large part because of him. There are others, including Cody Rhodes, who I think get a lot of that credit as well. And that's why I'm going to vote for Cody as well.
Is Cody's inclusion, like, is there any argument for Cody Rhodes pre-return to WWE? Or is this, like how much do you put into somewhat Cody of just the AEW impact is really what we're talking about? Because
I think the AEW impact is it's a large piece of the Young Bucks case. Not just that the Young Bucks were great wrestlers, which they are, and are maybe arguably one of the best, you know, maybe arguably the best in ring tag team ever. You could argue that, but the historical influence that the existence of AEW, especially now that we know it's probably going to be financially viable going forward, and the effect that has had on everybody throughout the industry, whether you're talent, whether you're staff working in the back or whatever it is, they could have, if they had made different choices, they could have just signed with WWE and worked for WWE and made great livings. But they decided to go along with this guy, Tony Khan, who had no business in the wrestling industry before, and start up a whole new company that has created a competitor, if for talent and staff, if nothing else.
I think that the Bucks have a very, very strong case. I give them more to the startup of AEW as being responsible than I do Cody, than even like a Kenny Omega. I mean, Jericho was very important, but I think at the contact first made was to the Young Bucks by Tony Khan, and you could certainly argue that. And it wasn't Jesse Collins brought this up. I think it's an important point that sometimes gets overlooked, is that it was not a case of just snapping your fingers and having this viable alternative right out of the gate and all that demand. It was the groundwork that was laid for years by the Young Bucks doing Being the Elite with the Bullet Club, and that they became like, they were the pulse of the independent scene that created this wave of demand that led to this explosion in 2019, and they got out of the gate so hot. I think a lot of that is from that indie boom period that the Bucks were leading the charge of for years, and seeing what they were doing at Ring of Honor and with the New Japan shows in the US. They were like, this was a real movement that they had cultivated, and Cody benefited from that too.
Yeah, the Bullet Club as a valuable piece of IP in the U.S. and helping New Japan become more popular in the U.S. The height of New Japan's popularity is when the Bucks and Cody too and Kenny Omega are big stars for that audience in the U.S. and Western markets generally.
Where is your hesitancy on Bill Goldberg? I don't see Bill Goldberg getting in, but I think he's one as well that I think, if you lived through 1998, I think that's the only way you can truly comprehend how incredibly popular this guy was. And at a time when, I mean, I think he very much salvaged a solid year of business for WCW at that period, and the ability to go into all of these domes. But I think it was just, it comes down to the length, and yeah. I guess your read on this comeback period, and you had kind of that outlier that year he spent in WWE that was kind of squandered, yeah, that we look back on. And I think if you had the right creative in mind, I think Goldberg could have really helped what was a giant a plateau for the company post Austin, post Rock. But it was a year that was certainly didn't help his candidacy.
Right. I think it's just a sporadic career, right? It's the 98-99, it's the 98 year, really. That's great.
It's really 98, yeah.
And then you have the rest of WWE's lifetime. And then it's the comeback in the, what was this year where he came back? It was
2016, he comes back.
Where he squashes Brock Lesnar in Toronto. Were you there for that?
Was Survivor I there for Series, that?
1 minute and 25 seconds. The thing is, he's got, so I'm looking at Cage Match. He's got 383 matches in his life. He's had a sporadic career, right?
That's how many Hulk Hogan did in a year because of the time change going to Japan and back. The 383 right. days a year of
that's right.
wrestling.
I think that's short a little bit. Yeah. So I think, you know, it's a strong contribution that he made to WWE, where he had in this comeback period, which is from 2016 to the present. There's 12 matches. It's 12 matches. Some of them include The Undertaker versus Goldberg.
How many were in Saudi Arabia? I would love to know what the per rate was that he, like per capita, how much he made per match.
No, three. 12.
Is that it?
Four, only maybe three? Four. No, okay. Roman Reigns, Bobby Lashley, The Fiend, Goldberg. Yeah, four out of those 12 are Saudi Arabia matches, where he made a lot of money, but a lot of those matches were not good. Did they draw money? It was guaranteed money to
those four matches drew $200 million, Brandon.
That's in a sense, yeah. We're starting to get into the parsing of the brand is the draw, and it was guaranteed TV rights money, guaranteed KSA money. So we could debate that further. I think he's close, and maybe I'll vote for him eventually, and maybe in a broader look back at history, I'll think you got to put Goldberg in, but I think he's close.
While we're on that, what do you think of the criteria, and do you think it accurately reflects what the business is today? Do you think it handicaps modern day performers, and we get into these discussions about a Roman Reigns, for instance, that like you can certainly look at some of these performers, like they are going to be a victim of their environments here.
Yeah. And I've given in, but I think it's ridiculous that we're voting for people who are 35 years old and older, right? That's the age limit. Uh-huh. I wish we were, and I've told Dave this, I wish we were voting for people who are 45 if he had a reason why to, you know, his perspective on it. I think that would be a lot safer to like, you know, when somebody's 45 years old, usually they've had the bulk of their career by that point. But we're voting for Cody Rhodes a bit early here. But I used to have this rule of like, I'm not going to vote for people who are of a certain age, but I've thrown my hands up at it. It's a different business. This is sort of the conversation we have a lot about how this used to be a ticket selling business, and it used to be about, you know, how many butts you could put in seats. And that was the make or break of whether this business was going to survive over the long term. And that's it. This is a media business. This is a video and live broadcast business now. And it's just not the business that it used to be. And being a draw, which is one of the three criteria that we're supposed to deal with right here. It's drawing power. It's performing quality, right? And third one is historical significance. So I think it's just that third criteria. It's just that one of those three criteria is it's still sort of the same lever in terms of how popular are you? How much can you compel people to make decisions to part with their money or their time? It's just analyzed with different metrics, I guess. I think I don't like the brand as the draw retort. I think that's there may be.
I think we've seen the difference, Brandon. Like we have seen like a WWE with a more engaging creative structure and what that means. Like,
don't the last few years dispute and undermine that argument?
Like this is not just your turnkey business that all these metrics, these are just interchangeable parts, and that creative is like, it makes no, like that was the thought going into the WWE Network eras, that there is no incentive to build up these pay-per-views because it's guaranteed. And that is not borne out. And we can now, we have gone through enough years here where we have the comparison point where you can go from 2018 through the end of the pandemic and then 2022 to the present and see what that difference is. And certain people that do make differences. We talked about this last year, and now that we do have the AEW rights deal solidified for the next 3 years, at least, where do you stand on a Tony Khan where, you know, I don't know when he becomes eligible, but he becomes a much more interesting candidate now that he has a second significant rights deal underneath him.
So I think you have to be 35 and 15 years in the business. So who knows how Dave will interpret this, but I think 15 years is 15 plus 2019. So that's what year would that be? 2035, somewhere around then. What's the math here?
Is that how far he is away? Well, then that's multiple administrations from now. So
that's 2033. If he, and I think that should be the rule. Like you got to have 15 years in the business.
What about message boards? Does that constitute, being in the industry, sending in television reports or live shows from Champaign, Illinois?
I don't think so. To make a company out of nothing, and to make it viable and the clear number two company in the world, that's a huge achievement. And it's certainly the beginning of a case. We'll see if AEW continues to do well, even if AEW were to crumble, after this deal, let's say they get canceled after the duration of this deal, it's still a pretty strong case that you made this company, you know, exist and be at least close to profitability, if not profitable, for the duration of the next term.
Here's our just engagement question. Okay, today on this date, they're both on the ballot. Is Tony Khan a stronger candidate on this ballot than Eric Bischoff?
I'm going to have to answer this offline.
Okay. I'm trying to bait you now.
Well, clearly, right? Now, Eric Bischoff had a really, really strong and successful 96, 97. You could even go maybe 95, 96, 97, 98. That's a relatively short run. And he didn't have as much responsibility relative to the company that he was running compared to Tony, who is not just the president who's being delegated these duties from the owner or whoever is above him in Turner. But Tony is the be-all, end-all, besides his dad, I guess. And WCW was, would you say WCW at its peak? 97? What would you say?
98. Yeah.
Is certainly more popular than AEW at any point.
Yes. Again, I always go back, like you go back and look at December 98 through January 4th, and in your mind, it's like, well, this is after WWF has taken over. Like, they run three dome shows in about 5 weeks, and they're drawing like 30,000 people for each of those shows. And yet the end result is your Finger Poke of Doom Georgia Dome show. But like that was just incredible business that they were drawing in late 98 and even into 99. Like, they're still drawing very well. It's just they are number two at that point. That I would state that really the drop off to me is like spring of 99, and then, you know, things just completely fall off the rails by the end of the year.
In terms of business, I don't know if any of those years were profitable. I bet there's somebody listening who knows whether or not WCW is profitable in what years. But in terms of revenues, in terms of popularity, whatever that means, and in ticket sales, pay-per-view buys in its peak, probably stronger than anything AEW's ever done. That's business output. Historical significance, AEW's a lot more historically significant than, well, I don't know, than the late 90s of WCW. You could certainly make an argument that WCW in the late 90s was extremely influential. And by God, look at the NWO. Let's give credit to Eric Bischoff for the NWO. I think there's a lot of credit that he deserves for that. I don't know.
Are you voting in the Japan category?
Yes.
I've got two. I'm voting for Shima. I vote for him every year. I think a very undervalued figure, especially in years when overall the Japanese industry was down, and yet Toriumon and succeeded by Dragon Gate, I think was highly influential and a very consistent company, not to mention, I think, great influence from just his in-ring to those he trained as well. So I'm voting for Shima, and I am voting for Shingo Takagi. Again, my ballot's not finished, but those are the two I see myself voting for.
I'm voting for no one in Japan.
Okay.
I just think this list of candidates, it's not quite. I just don't see any of them as Hall of Famers. Who's the closest? I know there are a lot of strong arguments for Shima. I get Shingo Takagi is a great wrestler. I'm not sure he's a big enough star. I don't buy Inoki and Sakaguchi as a Hall of Fame tag team. Inoki's already in. I lived through the peak, and I covered the peak Yoshiro Takayama years, and he was a big star in a really dark period. I'm sure there are fanatics of Fujiwara and people like that. I just don't see any of them as quite big enough stars.
And let's wrap up with non-wrestlers here. I mean, you just have such a wide array of just various contributors to the industry. That's really what this is, the contributors category. I for sure am voting for Bobby Bruns, Bobby Davis, and Morris Siegel. And I have a bunch of maybes on this. There's a 7-person maximum here. Yourself, you are...
I'm evidently voting again for the same three people. Jim Johnson, Reggie Parks, and Grand Wizard.
That is quite an eclectic three. Imagine that on table for three, the Brandon Thurston produced edition.
Yes. Yeah,
there's a lot of interesting ones here. I think Zane Bresloff, I think, is someone that I wish we had more definitive analysis of, because it's largely contained to Dave Meltzer's relationship with Zane Bresloff. And I would say the same with Koichi Yoshizawa, that again, it's like I never dealt with him myself, but from, you know, others that did, you know, significant when it came to the amount of information that probably would have been lost to history if not for someone relaying it from Japan. And then you have, you know, Bobby Davis is just, I think his case has just been strengthened each year. I think that the book that Tim Hornbaker wrote on Buddy Rogers kind of gave you a pretty deep look into him as well. Ditto for Morris Siegel, who I think the more and more history is research that is done into him, he probably should have been one on the initial list in 96, like somebody that just you know, really cultivated Texas and specifically Houston. May have been involved in some arenas being burnt to the ground. I mean, not proven, but he has been rumored, I guess. So I don't know how much you hold that against someone. If someone was found to have burnt down your building in a promotional war, Brandon, would that be disqualifying?
Did anybody die? What kind of damages are we talking about here?
I don't think any deaths. I think only damage to the building. I understand.
Did you damage to the business?
Yeah, I guess that's the question. It's like, were the drugs flushed down the toilet when this wrestler died? Did you protect the business at all costs?
Right,
these are the kinds of things that the Baseball Hall of Fame does not have to discuss.
Yes. So I'm going to vote for Jim Johnson, as I think the history of WWF is very different without his music. And really kind of
might get a bump this year with all the anger towards these WWE themes. I think there might be some nostalgia here that it's going to prop up Jim Johnston.
Yeah, and it makes, I think, wrestling theme music kind of what it ended up becoming, or what it's remembered best for, besides licensed music. And Reg Parks, the belt maker, I think there's room for one person in their era who's by far the greatest, or the greatest in his or her category. And Grand Wizard, I think, drew a lot of money. As you sort of think of them as the person who was opposing the perennial WF champions at the time. And I always remember when we're reviewing the Grand Wizard candidacy, here's a guy who was Jewish, right? And he decided to name himself after the term that is used for the leader of the KKK, just to stick it to him.
You can't knock that line of thinking to defeat prejudice in the 70s.
Is there anybody who should be on this ballot? Not just this category, but any category. That's not on the ballot.
Oh, that's not on the ballot. Do you have some off the top of your head? That might get my... I'll just
say what I said last year. If we're looking at non-wrestlers and we're putting in journalists, I understand Dave's not going to put himself on here. Why isn't Wade Keller on here?
Reporters seem to be the one area that has not been open to it. I guess it kind of is... I don't know. I would have to get into Dave's head on if he starts to put reporters on.
I've never like written the email to him, but it's
I think reporters would be perfectly logical to add to this, and I guess maybe is
are there not reporters on here already, or have there not been? Would you not consider
James Melby? I guess is your closest to it. Would that be the only reporter, like per se, that we? Oh, I guess Koichi Yoshizawa would be another one. Kind of, that seems to be the extent of them. I mean, kind of slash historians here as well.
It's publishers like Stanley Weston.
Yeah. I mean, not. It's weird. Like Stanley Weston was not so much like. I don't know. Reporter has like such a wide definition, I think, of what would be on here. But I certainly like a Wade Keller. I think as we look back, especially like this year, where so much of us have been focusing on like the Ring Boy scandal, like who was covering this in 1992? Like it's like for a lot of these stories that like it was a very small number of people that were covering this that were not like, you know, talk shows.
And the one thing that I appreciate about Wade's work is you look back at it and he's reporting like a real journalist and you know, citing his sources and attributing in a way that is professional. in an era where it's like it's newsletters and people are just sort of, you know, treating it like it's a letter to their buddies.
Well, there you go. That is the Observer ballot. I'll also mention for the historical category, I will be voting for Johnny Russo for sure. I've got a bunch of maybes. I have to go through this ballot later tonight, but I have not finished my ballot, so I got to do this tonight. I'm
voting for June Byers in the historical category.
June Byers is on my list here.
Which, by the way, how many Japanese women's wrestlers, how many women wrestlers are there in the Hall of Fame who are not Japanese women?
Zero.
One.
One.
Mildred Burke.
Mildred Burke is in the Hall of Fame.
All the rest are either Japanese or they made their careers in Japan. I think, like, literally they're all.
Is Becky Lynch the strongest female on the ballot? I'm not voting for Becky Lynch, but she is probably. I mean,
who's the other one? Trish.
Yeah, the other one's Trish, and Becky is a much stronger candidate than Trish.
Yes, I would agree.
All right, there you go. Maybe we'll talk about this when the results come out of who gets in, who does not, and let the debates begin. But we have gone lengthy on this Thursday edition of Pollock and Thurston. Again, want to send a thank you to Robert Jackman for joining us, and for Mark Shapiro, always waxing poetic on these earnings calls, and then giving us a Easter egg this morning in the form of 23 minutes with Alex Sherman, former guest at Pollock and Thurston. So you can go check out that full interview and the spinoff of Breakfast with Blassie, Breakfast with Vince.
Yes. I wish they had recorded that for their own documentary, for Vince's new media company, maybe.
All right, that's going to wrap things up. Thanks to everyone for joining us. We're back next week, our usual day and time, Wednesdays at 1 Eastern, for another riveting edition of Pollock and Thurston. Goodbye.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.